I'd like to welcome the elders wherever two or three are gathered together, I guess is what we'll have here, but that's all right. There was an old hymn, I forget which of the color hymn books it was in, the red or the blue or the black, or it's not in the green, I know, but you know, it goes, the title is How Blessed Is This Small Band? And so there'll be plenty of opportunity for all of us to, you know, for us to discuss. What I'd like to be talking about during this week and then also next week is what I've called in a sort of grandiose way, religious faith and public policy. And I don't want it to be just simply, you know, politics, or, you know, religion and politics, because that old saw and that old cliche has been pretty well, I think, eliminated or worn down to where it doesn't have any significant meaning, I think, for us anymore. But what I want to try to do is raise the questions of what difference does our religious faith make for the way in which we have to get along in this world in terms of our in terms of public policy. And as nice as we would like to have a world that doesn't have all the difficulties and the problems and the complexities of living in living the way we would like to, obviously we have all kinds of obligations and responsibilities and commitments. And I think to start off with a statement that's, you know, very familiar, I think, to almost all of us, coming from Edmund Burke, that the surest way for evil to triumph in the world is for good people to do nothing. And as I say many times, I would like to avoid, you know, avoid the responsibilities and not go around with the necessity of caucuses and all that, and fundraisers and being informed and all that, but I think obviously we do. So I'll be talking about a wide variety of these subjects. Today, we'll let the secret out now, Pac-Man doesn't mean the, you know, the Atari game some says that swept the country for a while. And then I was pleased to say, you know, we and I were talking briefly about it. It seems to have slipped because right before Christmas last year, when they thought Atari stock was going to go way up, right before Christmas, it went way down. And this befuddled the, you know, the stockbrokers. And I was kind of happy to see it because, as we were talking about, I think the Pac-Man things and all the arcade games are, deal just with destruction. You always have to get somebody or knock somebody out or destroy somebody. And that may have some implications for the future that we want to, you know, we want to think about. But what I want to talk about is what I call Pac-Man, or, you know, political action committees. And they came in at a time when the Atari PACs, or the Atari Pac-Man caught on, and so it got to be sort of a cute little title, and I shamelessly borrowed my title, except for the DC thing, from, it's either Time or Newsweek, which did a story, was it? I forget which one. They're interchangeable. I say they're interchangeable because when we were in northern Thailand, the same man wrote the stories for both Time and Newsweek in Chiang Mai. So we began to wonder, and he made it a little bit different so they didn't come out exactly the same, because some people, if they read both editions of the Far Eastern edition of Time and Newsweek, might wonder if they were getting exactly the same thing. But it'll be on Political Action Committee, and I want to talk about that in some detail because it's raising, I think, lots of important implications for us. And then also tonight, I think it's at 6:45, not quite used to the new schedule, it'll be on creationism, which is, I want to take up not from the standpoint that we did last night of science and religion, but as a matter of public policy, as a matter of constitutional, you know, issues. Because in a very real sense, what we are doing is turning the teaching of this very important phase of our children's education over to a public institution. And that has all kinds of implications. Do we really want, you know, to turn that over to the government? In a very real sense, the public school is the government. And then I want to be talking about, I think it's on Thursday, sort of a more positive note. It'll be a fairly negative note today. More positive note on what I call religion on Capitol Hill, and raise the question with us, you know, should we expect or should we look for the religious commitment of, you know, of office seekers as a qualification for office? Should we expect that we know their religious, you know, and ethical commitment take an interest in voting for them? And then on Friday, I want to talk about the last days, and you might wonder, you know, are we in the last days? What in the world does the last days have to do with public policy? But I think the last days have a lot to do with public policy, because if you know the premillennial scheme, you know that the belief is that we can't have the Battle of Armageddon until a war starts in Israel. All right, let's, you know, that there has to be, the horde has to come down from the north, which I think is out of Ezekiel somewhere, and that's interpreted as the USSR. And they'll start a battle in Israel. All right, if that's the case, and say we have a premillennialist in charge of our foreign policy in the Middle East, obviously he or she will want the war to continue. Because that'll mean that the Armageddon is here, and the sooner Armageddon is here, the sooner we can have, you know, the literal millennium. So there are all kinds of implications. That's all I'm trying to say with our public policy and our religious faith. And we'll have a, you know, lots of chance to talk about that. And I'll have to two more introductory things. I come from the state of Minnesota, and I'm used to the style of our dearly beloved and late Senator Hubert Humphrey. And I always supported Hubert because we both talk too fast, and neither of us, you know when to quit. So if I go too fast, just give me a sign, a flag, and I, you know, I'm too old to change. So and Hubert was too, and we miss him. We really miss him there. Anyway, that's another story. That I won't go into Minnesota politics with you for. And the other thing is, I would like to, like last night, make this as much of a public or much of a discussion as possible. I've found in my years teaching here that Holden has remarkable resources from many people, and we can learn from one another and not just simply have a teacher up here, you know, pontificating. And I found that the most, you know, important meaning times for growth for me have been when people have been open and willing to share and learn from one another. And you're not undergraduates out there, thank goodness, who have, you know, as little interest as possible in sort of surviving the hour. And you're here, you know, for other reasons. And having just been through, was it 36 weeks? It seems much longer. You know, of undergraduates, it's nice to have somebody who's, you know, has a different interest. All right. Anyway, political action committees, and I think they illustrate a fascinating principle in the whole matter of trying to improve the moral quality of our public life, because nobody questioned the fact that in terms of funding, you know, people running for office, how do you, that's basically the sort of the specific issue we want to talk about. How do you fund, you know, and how do you conduct fundraising campaigns for people for public office, and what does this mean for their, you know, their vote? Nobody questioned the fact that we really needed to change the system. Everybody agreed to do this, and let's the argument, let's make this a much more moral, a much more ethical kind of system. But what's happened is, I'll try to show, and I'll be using the famous New Yorker article here by Elizabeth Drew on the PAC committee thing, is that what happened is that we've actually, with the best of intentions, made the situation worse. As unbelievable as it might sound, coming right after Watergate, you remember with laundered money and bank accounts in Mexico, you remember all those things, maybe you just as soon forget some of those things, and Donald Segretti, and maybe I shouldn't mention names like that, you sort of thought that those names would be gone once and for all, and Jeb Magruder and you know, other ghosts from the past, they would probably just as soon stay there. Actually, it seems, and I think Drew is right when she argues this, that the situation is as bad and probably worse than it was at that particular time. So, to turn specifically to this, and I'd like to, you know, keep up significant eye contact here, but this is the first time through on this material for me, and if I read a little bit too much, it's simply because it is new, and if nothing else, I didn't go to the file and bring back a few old, you know, lectures for this round at Holden. Sometimes you can do that if you're not ready for a class or something like that, or sometimes if you forget your notes, you have to wing it. That happened to me last, this is one last story and then I'll start. Happened to me last, when was it, October, I was doing a lecture series out at Augustana Lutheran Church in Denver. And sure enough, I got to the wrap up, the 11 o'clock Saturday morning, you know, wrap up. And then, you know, the lunch afterwards, and then free time, and so on. And I went at 10:30 when there was the coffee break. And this is the Augustana Church at the big one downtown in the LCA Church in Denver. But anyway, Swenson was his. Is that, you know, I know, I thought it might be a friend of yours, but anyway, I went at 10:30 to be to my briefcase, sure that I had my 11 o'clock lecture there, and, you know, the cupboard was bare. It wasn't there, and I made some fast notes during coffee hour. I didn't enjoy the, you know, the fellowship of coffee that time. And afterwards, people said, that's the best lecture you gave out of the three. So, you know, begin to wonder, maybe I should just forget these notes and, you know, start all over again. With this. But anyway, Drew argues that we're in the middle of what she calls a transformation, even a revolution, in the way in which political candidates' elections really are funded. And this is really symbolized by the appearance on the scene of what we call PACs, or political action committees, which came into being really in the late 1970s, and whose activities are profound and for many people very alarming. And so powerful is their potential that, and this is what Drew says, that their continued impact would probably eliminate traditional restraints and rewards on our congressmen. In other words, they really have the potential for changing the whole system in which we actually decide what laws should be made and how they should be made itself. And she starts off with a wonderful quotation from Harry Truman, as only Harry could do with a salty language. He said, "Some people like the government so much that they try to buy it." And like the man who bought the Remington Rand because he liked the shaver so much. You remember from your TV commercials, and Dan wouldn't know what I'm talking about. He probably hasn't seen TV for 3 or 4 years. Okay. And Drew says this: "The role that money is currently playing in American politics is different both in scope and in nature from anything that's gone before. The acquisition of campaign funds has become an obsession on the part of nearly every candidate for federal office." That's a strong statement. It's become an obsession. "The obsession leads candidates to solicit and accept money from those most able to provide it." In other words, you simply go for where the money is, where it's most available. "And to adjust," and the candidates then adjust their behavior in office to the need for money. See, that's what's happening. The money is out there. The money is available. And since, as we'll be talking about, campaigns are costing more and more all the time, people are going to where the money is available. And they are, as she puts it so discreetly here, adjusting their behavior in office to the need for money. Or if you don't do that, you have to recognize that the man or woman who's trying to unseat you probably knows where the money is, and they're going to come up in the next election with more money for campaigning than you are. The money is there, and therefore the threat is to what, how it's going to be used. Now, the problem, of course, becomes how did all this, since it is this serious, how did it start? What started this revolution or this transformation? And again, as I've suggested before, it was with the best of intentions that the political action committees got started. And in and of themselves, they aren't what we would call inherently bad or inherently evil. But they are intended to, this is the point, they are intended to be campaign committees which are made up of like-minded individuals to raise money for political purposes. That's what a political action committee is. You've got a specific goal or task or objective, in mind, so you find other people who have the same things in mind, and you come together legally to form an association or a committee to raise money for political purposes, especially for the election of lawmakers. And these rose out of the need, especially for serious campaign funding reform that came out of Watergate, as I've suggested before. In the wake of disclosures from Watergate, the laundered money, for instance, the fact that in 1972, 17 individuals gave $24 million, to one party. That has a ring to it, doesn't it? 17 people gave $24 million. And that sort of, raises a certain number of issues here. That was to the Republican National Committee campaign chest, and all the shenanigans that went on with that, as I've already mentioned before. Congress decided after the 72, campaign to act, and the question of is what did they decide to do? A very sensible solution. They decided to limit the amount of money that contributors can make, and limit the amount of money not only that individuals can make, but limit the amount of money that corporations and unions could make, or anything or any group that's incorporated. Obviously, and I say it's incorporated is important because then you can trace where the money is going. If something's incorporated, they have to report their funds, and that way you can trace them, and they obviously wanted to know who's spending, how much money where. So the idea was to limit the amount of money that individuals can contribute, in limit the amount of money that any group that's incorporated can make, be it a union, be it a corporation, be it the American Medical Association, National Rifle Association, whatever it might be. Get rid of the influence, in other words, once and for all, of what we call the fat cats. The fattest of all the cats, I suppose, would be someone, you probably remember the Chicago hotel billionaire W. Clement Stone, who, whenever they needed money for something, would simply call up, and Stone's only question was, how much? And the idea was to get rid of these people, once and for all, to get rid of the influence of wealthy corporations, of wealthy unions, and give the financing, over to smaller contributors. The idea is, to make the government more responsive, to make the people feel they were more directly involved, personally involved with it, and therefore, limit the size of gifts or contributions that could be made. All right. So that was the basic idea. with it. It sounds good, fine. Get more people involved. You know, this instead of thinking that the government is just something that, you know, the very wealthy out there control, make it something everybody can get involved in. All right, now, then, very briefly here, and all these bills are very complicated, but I think the essential terms of the bill would go something like that. You create what are called political action committees. Now, on paper they sound, you know, innocuous. A political action committee can give $5,000 to an individual's campaign chest. They can give $5,000. That doesn't sound like very much. So why get excited? If you can only give $5,000, that probably pays for two or three spots, you know, on a TV program from 5:30 to, you know, to 6 or something like that. To give $5,000 to both the primary and to the general election campaign. Now, that was what a political action committee can give, $5,000. An individual person can give only $1,000. Well, that's a whole lot less than 17 people giving $24 million. So you can say only one individual, you know, whoever it might be, can only give, $1,000 to each candidate. All right. Now, another limitation with political action committees was that these were limited only to Congress or to the House of Representatives and to the Senate. There are no political action committees for the presidency. They are only for Congress, that is for the two houses of Congress, obviously. Because presidential campaigns are funded largely, you know, by the dollar or two, whatever it is that you check off on your 1040. Remember, it's up about this year, about the third of the way. Maybe you just as soon not think or remember your 1040. If I try to remind you where your checkoff box was on your 1040 and so on, I went through the usual trauma again. Didn't come out too well this year. But presidential campaigns are financed by the, you know, the checkoff system, but the congressional aren't. Now, just to give you some indication of how rapidly these have caught on, just a couple statistics here. I know statistics are boring. In 1982, there were 3,149 PAC committees, 3149. That was up from 2251 2 years before, which gives you some indication of how rapidly they caught on. In the 1982 campaigns, the political action committee spent $240 million. That was an increase of 45% from 1980. Something's going on here. When people see those kind of statistics, you know, something's happening. This isn't just a minor technical adjustment, as they like to call it on Wall Street, or a market adjustment. But when something like that goes up 45% in 2 years, obviously something's going on. People like what they're getting. That's the point from the increase going up 45%. They like what the contributors are happy about. Their returns, their dividends, what they're getting back, and people have a funny habit of wanting to put their money where they think it's going to do them some good, and when they see it doing some good, they're going to keep putting money, you know, into that same place. All right. Now the next question is, you know, do these political action committees work? Do the PACs work? There are 535 members in the two houses. That's right. Well, we have 100 senators, of course. 50 say states, 2 senators, and we have 435 members in the House. 535 altogether. Only 12 congressmen refused any PAC money. Only 12 of the 535. So obviously, the congressmen see what's happening, what's going on here. Okay. And when that many people take them, obviously they aren't inherently wrong or bad or evil along that line. And the hopes, you know, as the political action committees went through, were very high. And I'll quote Elizabeth Drew on this. The result of all this is that the basis on which our system of government was supposed to work is slipping away. That's a very bold statement. The basis on which our system of government was supposed to work is slipping away, if it is not already gone. The role of the public representative has been changing dramatically in recent years. That's what I'm going to be talking about a little bit. I think it's tomorrow night, too. And there is a new politics going on. I'm going to call it the church and the new politics. There is something very new going on, and we're sort of in the forefront of this sort of thing. The ability of even the best of the legislators to focus on broad questions, to act independently, or to lead has been seriously impaired. That's something worth repeating. The ability of even the best of the legislators to focus on broad questions, to act independently, or to lead has been seriously impaired. The race for money on Capitol Hill has been turned into what one House member has called a fever that has taken over the Hill. That's, you know, Capitol Hill. Politicians who seek to enter and do not have great wealth of their own to spend are signed up on a systematic basis by interests who wish to enjoy influence over their official conduct. many estimable peoples are concluding that they would prefer not to enter at all. In other words, what's happening is that the money is there, and it's accessible, and it's attracting people to Congress who aren't necessarily the best qualified people, you know, for Congress. And I think it's fair to say that oftentimes we don't get much better legislation than the kind of people we have there at all. So, you know, the influences are, and as I'll talk about in a minute right here, this isn't the old kind of lobbying. This isn't the old smoke-filled rooms kind of thing. This isn't, W. Clement Stone writing out a check, you know, for asking the chairman of the National Committee, how much do you want? It's a whole different thing. There has always been influence in Washington. Some of us here will remember in 1950, LBJ was embarrassed by his, when he was Senate Majority Leader, by his chief assistant, Bobby Baker. I don't know if that name rings a bell with some of you. And Bobby Baker today would be peanuts. It wouldn't really be worth putting into the petty cash fund with this. Or Eisenhower, you remember, had Sherman Adams, who liked coats, wasn't it? Vicuna coats and fancy rugs. And Harry Truman had his name named Harry Vaughan, wasn't it, who liked the deep freezer too. And everybody got excited when somebody, some lobbyist sent Vaughan a deep freeze. Today, you know, that wouldn't even make a wrinkle in you know what's going on at this time. Something really new, according to Drew, is going on. Politicians today need more money. And as she puts it so politely, they are lowering their threshold of principle. That's a discreet way of putting it. They are lowering their threshold of principle on this. And even if they don't need a lot, they think they need a lot. And there is always, for instance, the fear that your opponent has his or her hand in the cookie jar where the political action committee money is. So if you're going to be principled and not take the money, by golly, by the time the next campaign comes around, there's your opponent, you know, very highly financed. So even if you might not want to, you have this funny habit of wanting to be reelected. You know, there's nothing so useless as a politician out of office. Just ask George McGovern, is a classic example. We had him on campus this year, and fascinating to see what he's doing. Or, some of the others, the other one, Gaylord Nelson, and so on. All right. So we've got a very real, you know, kind of problem here. Now, the next point I'd like to make, you know, besides the terms of the act, specifically then, when you've got all this money, when you've got the political action committees functioning and organized, you know, how exactly do they work? How do they work? What really is the way in which they operate? First, it has to be said, and I'll say this too when I have a sum up, that there is very little, if anything, here that's secret, and that's a step ahead. They have to declare everything. They have to declare and send to the appropriate government official office where they're spending the money and how they're working. And so there, as I say, there are very few, if any, kind of smoke-filled rooms anymore. And in that sense, you know, it's a step ahead. But what's happening now is that since there's so much money available, they don't really much care, when people like Elizabeth Drew write critical articles, because they have the opportunity to make, you know, such significant progress in what they're trying to do, that they simply go ahead with this. Okay. Now, there are really two kinds of political action committees that I want to talk about here very briefly. Two kinds of them. I'm not the kind that likes to work from the board, so I won't get up. And once I get sort of settled in, I like to sort of to sit. I should have probably put this on the board, but I know I appreciate other people who are more visual, but I'm not. All right. There are, you know, there are two kinds of political action committees. Those who work for specific, you know, for specific legislation, who want specific things done. Specific action groups. These would be, for instance, the National Association of Manufacturers. This would be the labor unions. This would be the American Medical Association. This would be the, you know, the Realty Board. This would be various shipping groups, auto dealers, bankers, dental associations. All the, you know, the economic factions who come together and want specific things done. All right, that's one kind of specifics. And then the second group would be what we call the ideological groups. The groups who really aren't as much interested in specific legislation as they are in electing people of their own political ideology to office. And what's happening, for reasons we can go into, is that there's far more pressure from conservative ideological groups, you know, to get their people elected than there are from the liberal ones. It's not that conservatives necessarily have more money, it's simply that they're simply much better organized and much more, you know, militant in what they're doing. All right, now, so you've got the two groups. Now, how do they work? Let me go through this a little bit. They work in several ways, and here will be just a few examples. Each of these large, you know, specific groups that I've talked about here has its own trade association. I think you know what trade associations are. They want to know what's happening in Washington. They want to know if, you know, is there any pending legislation that might help or might hurt them. They want to know how they can, or another thing, they want to know how they can, you know, improve their image with the general public. Let me give you a good example. I don't know about, you know, your part of the country, but one of the big promos in the last 3 or 4 years in Minnesota has been, you know, the TV advertisements for full service bankers, and they come on friendly and smiling. They always give you a big, you know, big solid, you know, vault. In other words, they are solid and stable, and your money's always there. Whereas the people they're obviously aiming at are, you know, savings and loans, and they're considered to be a little less shaky. I mean, a little more shaky, and everything else. So that would be. And so what's happened is that full service banks have created their own national trade association. And they then have, and all the others do too, as I talked about, the Realtor Shipping Industry, NEA, the National Education Association, National Rifle Association, all have their offices, obviously, for what to get done what they want done in Washington. Okay. And the leaders of these associations come together then in Washington and decide what kind of legislation they want passed or that they want blocked. They decide this is what our goals, you know, for legislation will be in the next in the next session. All right, so that's all perfectly legal. You can in fact find this prophesied as far back as 1787 when James Madison wrote the famous Federalist Paper number 10, when he said that the thing that really makes the government go, the basic issues in government are always the economic interests that are going on, all the different economic factions you know, that are at work. And that hasn't changed at all, and there's nothing, you know, reprehensible about this. Okay. So once the trade associations then get together, they decide what kind of legislation they want, then they have the money, you see, to spend, all right? Then they decide, well, the only way we get legislation passed is, you know, take it to various friends or hopeful friends or potential friends we have in Washington. They look at the voting records and the general disposition, you see, of potential supporters in the House and in the Senate. And they don't try to win the support of everybody. They're not foolish enough to try to win over everybody's support. They don't have enough money, in other words, also to give to everybody for trying to get the kind of legislation that they want. But they will select, for instance, say 150 or 200 people in the House for special targeting. They will take their funds, and they can raise funds, you see, from their associations. There might be state associations, you know, the Minnesota Board of Realtors, let's say, or whatever it might be, or the Washington Used Car Association, or whatever. These people contribute money, and they can focus it all in Washington. And let's say the used car dealers, because that raises that there's an interesting bill that's just come up there. They can take this money, let's say $2,500,000, and they can dole it out in $5,000 packages to each one of the people they try to influence, all completely, you know, legal with this. They can dole it out or to, you know, as I say, in $5,000 parcels to those they think might vote their way. And they are very sophisticated in knowing, you know, what the lawmaker might do for them, and especially with computers, they have all the information they want to furnish to the lawmaker on what kind of bills are coming up and how they would like these bills passed. For instance, on the balanced budget amendment or the mortgage subsidy bill or on interest rates. All this is very complicated, and what they found is that a lot of times lawmakers' staffs aren't all that sophisticated themselves to be able to understand what's going on, and hence the trade associations through the political action committees can furnish these people with the information that they want, and also can furnish them with information to refute their critics. You know, a lawmaker say, well, I want to support you, but how am I going to answer my critics? I don't have a big enough staff, you know, to do the research to reply to the, you know, to the man who's trying to take my job, you know, from back home. And the trade associations, you know, would be able to furnish, you know, the people with this. In other words, in a very real sense here, they're replacing political parties. In a very, and that raises all kinds of implications, replacing political parties. All right. So they find the people they think will vote for them, and they give them the money. And it's all open. I've got some, I'll read it later on, some information on how the money was spent in the 1982 Minnesota campaign, just as an example. And it's all there right out in front. Okay. Now, this you know, this is all this, these would be with the specific groups. Now, with the ideological ones, the story is a little bit different. They aren't so much interested in specific bills themselves, but what they're interested in is electing people who will vote the same way ideologically as the others. And the most famous one of these, of course, is the National Conservative Political Action Committee. Does the name Terry Dolan ring a bell? Okay, I just want to know how much information you have with this. Dolan became something of a heavy, or what we call a point man, for much like who was David, the fellow with the budget for Reagan's budget director. Stockman, right, who became the point man to do all the controversial work with Congress. Terry Dolan is the head of the National Conservative Political Action Committee, who is able to carry the ideological torch for their campaign. All right. So what they did, and the most famous time of this was, of course, in 1980, they developed what we call the hit list. I think you all remember the hit or the targets list of 1980. And they found that they would like to get rid of certain senators and certain congressmen, not all of them, because they knew some obviously couldn't be defeated. So they spent a great deal of money, and let's see if I can remember them. It was Birchbein, Indiana. It was Nelson in Wisconsin. John Culver, I want to say something about him, in Iowa. McGovern in South Dakota. Frank Church in Idaho. And then they defeated all five of those, and they tried with Cranston, Alan Cranston, in California, of course, and lost. All right. So they decided on the basis of, you know, having six targeted senators, that they didn't much care about, you know, what their replacements would, how they would vote, but they decided these six senators could be defeated. Then they got confident and targeted 18 senators for the 1982 campaign. Obviously, every year 1/3 of the Senate is up for re-election, and they targeted 18. But what happened was that in all 18 cases, the National Conservative Political Action Committee failed. None of the 18 people which they targeted for defeat in 1982 were returned to office. They were all the people that they didn't want to have returned to office were elected, and they learned a couple of very important things. For one thing, the American public had become a little bit more sophisticated about what they were trying to do. I'll give you two good examples. In very heavy amounts of money were spent in Maryland against Paul Sarbanes, the incumbent senator, and also not too far from here, I don't know his first name, Melker from Montana. He's a veterinarian, so everybody calls him Doc. But anyway, they spent a great deal of money there, and what Sarbanes and Melker were able to do was to take the outside money coming in and turn it to their own advantage. They went on TV and said, look, they would have people getting off the planes. I mean, this was all simulated, but they would have people getting off the planes, obviously, you know, East Coast, well-dressed people, with bags, obviously, you know, theoretically stuffed with money, just like our old carpetbaggers from, you know, the North going south after the Civil War. And they say, is this the way you want government run in, you know, Montana? Don't you want Montanans, you know, taking care of our own interests? And don't you want old Doc Melker? And he came on as an old, you know, cow veterinarian with probably a little, you know, leftover from the cows on his boots and the rest. And you know, poised as a nice juxtaposition to the, you know, the slick, smooth, sophisticated city slicker kind of Eastern politician. And it worked. And the same thing happened in Maryland. In fact, what Sarbanes did was take the very negative campaign materials of the National Conservative Political Action Committee and turn it to his own advantage, and it got so successful that 2 weeks before the election came, Sarbanes' opponent just dropped out altogether. You know, it worked. So there are some reasons to be a little bit successful about this. But on the other hand, we can see the Political Action Committee working in a different way. Now, many of you are interested in the ecological issues, and I picked this example out of the many because it illustrates how political action committees can work. Okay. And I think this is a very specific one, and it comes right out of Iowa. In Iowa, the incumbent senator was a man named John Culver. Nothing distinguished, but nothing really bad either. John Culver. All right. Culver was opposed by the National Conservative Political Action Committee by a man by the name of Reverend Charles Grassley. And it sounded as though this was a, you know, good guys, bad guys, white hats, black hats kind of thing. But that really wasn't the case. Grassley raised over $700,000 from political action committees. $700,000, that's a lot of money, you know, in Iowa. You probably don't need that much to win a campaign in Iowa. But and Jesse Helms, if it's any consolation to any of you, has over $6 million ready for his next war, for his next campaign, although he's in trouble too, as we can talk about later. But anyway, Grassley raised over $700,000. How? Grassley's money came mostly from oil and chemical interests and companies after Culver had guided through Congress a bill requiring these companies to contribute to a super fund for cleaning up toxic wastes. Culver took the lead in a campaign to put stronger controls over toxic waste from the oil and chemical companies. And when that came, when the oil and chemical companies saw what was happening, and they saw that they could influence Grassley, they went to work. Grassley's political action director was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "In the early morning, we started calling the East Coast PACs, and we worked across the country with the sun." In other words, they knew that each oil and chemical company had a certain amount of money that they perfectly legally could contribute, and they did. And the and they were each of these companies then was able to spend $5,000. If you divide $5,000 into $700,000, you find out how many PACs then were organized to be able to, you know, give money to Grassley rather than to Culver. And obviously, you know, Culver lost, if you hadn't heard. And even my sister, who's been a lifelong Republican in good old Winnebago County, has to admit that she's not all that enthusiastic about the person, because he just doesn't seem to have what she thought they would have. All right. So that's one way in which, you know, in which influence could be, you know, can be gained. But there are other ways too. Another way is a very important one, and it's catching on with greater popularity all the time, is the fundraiser. And the fundraiser is either a cocktail party or a dinner. The lobbies are there, and they invite the congressmen to come in and, you know, talk over things informally. Both sides, you know, size each other up. I mean, you will, if you're a PAC, you will have a dinner, you might have a cocktail party, whatever kind of reception it is, and the congressmen will come. And they will talk back and forth. No promises, nothing written down, you know, nothing in stone, nothing in writing and all the rest, but have a way of sort of sizing each other up. And if some sort of informal understanding can be reached then between the PAC and the congressmen, then the staffs of each can continue the negotiations. It's, you know, a rather easy way of doing that. All right, now, the question, of course, becomes, what's the bottom line here? Do they really, you know, do the PACs really expect that they can buy votes? That's the old traditional, you know, interpretation. The answer there, and according to Drew, and I think she's right on this, is that they don't expect necessarily to buy votes, because most congressmen would bristle at the idea that, you know, that they can be bought. And I think that's a fair assessment, that there isn't an out-and-out sort of crude, you know, bargaining process the way it was maybe even 20 years ago. But at the minimum, what can be done through political action committees is what we call access. You gain access to the congressman, which you didn't have before. He's not necessarily totally dependent on you, but he will certainly listen carefully to what you have to say. You have access to him. And this is what Senator Culver, who was defeated by political action committee, says. "There's no question that money gives you real access. The members have to get their money someplace," which is true, they have to get their money someplace, "and they are grateful for the contributions. It's much easier, for instance, to go to a PAC fundraiser and get your $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever it is than to have to go back home and have to have a chicken dinner kind of reception where you have to do all the things and stand in line." One wonderful thing in the 1968 campaign was, everybody goes to New Hampshire, the first primary, and there was a story once where Pat and Richard Nixon were in a reception line in a small gymnasium in New Hampshire, and Pat in her high heels had to stand for 3 hours and shake hands with some potential fundraisers, you know, in New Hampshire. Well, I've never stood in line for 3 hours on a wooden floor, but I'm sure, you know, in high heels, but I'm sure it'll be a very painful sort of thing. And all I only mention that because all of that suddenly now is gone. You don't have to do that anymore. You can simply call on a few friends or a few potential contributors, and all that's taken away. All right. Now, another point that Drew makes, and I think it's a good one, is that many times, in fact, in most legislation, that most bills before Congress don't involve great moral principles. They don't involve great moral principles. Most of these are strictly economic kinds of bills. And the lobbyists understand that a little persuasion will turn the trick. They don't have to make everything into an epic, struggle between good and evil, between right and wrong. And if an issue doesn't involve a high moral principle, and if it doesn't involve, you see, an important constituency group, the member is open to persuasion. That is, he knows where people will back home will get excited and where they won't. All right? And if he senses that the people back home aren't going to get excited about a particular bill in Minnesota, there won't be many people except up north who would be interested in some shipping bills. You know, you're not going to convince a farmer in southern Minnesota that he has a vital interest in how Senator Durenberger or Senator Boschwitz votes on shipping bills. So they know that, and therefore they can be open to persuasion, you know, from groups where they don't feel any kind of pressure at home. And as Drew concludes on this, he who has access is most likely to persuade. All right, and another way in which the PACs have influence, besides these ways that I've talked about here through, you know, Grassley with the oil and chemical and all the rest, is that they are able to understand and to explain in very clear and precise terms all the very complicated and technical legislation that's going on. PACs are there to help congressmen with advice, with information. And congressmen don't have the time. Their staffs oftentimes aren't very sophisticated. You, for instance, we've got a new congressman from our district. This is the first time there do some things do change in history. This is the first time in the history of the state of Minnesota we've had a Democrat from the first congressional district. And our district started in 1858. So that's a trend. When you don't get a Democrat from 1858 to 1982, and his name is Tim Penny, fine, you know, okay, fine guy, and everything. But his staff is young. They're new. They're inexperienced. He wants to bring his own staff in. That's the whole name of the game. People work for you because then, if you win, then you'll go to Washington. Everybody wants to go to Washington and, you know, be influential. Well, that means we've got, you know, one of the 435 congressmen with an inexperienced staff. I mean, there are some people who stay on no matter who's in office. I mean, secretaries and people like this stay on and everything else, but they aren't the policymakers. All right. But Penny's staff is new and inexperienced, and I'm not saying he's, you know, he's influenced, but at least he's open to all the help and the advice that he can get. And as I suggested, the PACs, you know, present all the information that you need for this. And hence, what Drew is suggesting is that they really become dependent on their, you know, their sources of funding. The old ideal of Edmund Burke, of a legislature leading his constituents rather than simply reacting, is disappearing. And this is, as she says, the role of money has delivered us into the special interest state. And, you know, this is why there's a whole new ballgame in Washington and why so many times it seems so difficult for anything to be done. But I think some things can be done, and, you know, the situation isn't altogether, you know, bad. It isn't altogether, I think, irredeemable. All right, now let me sort of shift here and sort of go into the next part and talk about some, I think, some rather positive or constructive aspects of this, and then, you know, see where we come out with this. For one thing, we have to be realistic about this, and just like, you know, Railroad Creek is going to find Lake Chelan, money that business wants to spend for legislation is going to find its way to the proper source. Rivers are always going to find their way to the sea. In other words, special interest money will always find a way to flow into campaigns. That's never going to be eliminated. We just simply sort of start from that. And the Political Action Committee channel, you see where it is now, keeps the process regulated and open to public scrutiny. Let me give you, you know, just one example from this. This came out after the Minnesota 1982 campaign. A list here, this is just from the Democratic Party, of who spent how much money contributing to, in this particular case, it happened to be our governor, Governor Rudy Perpich, who's Minnesota's own unguided missile, as we like to call Rudy. And it's not everybody who could have a polka mass on the day he was inaugurated, you know, to the governorship. And if you don't know, that's an inside joke, and I just hope polka masses don't spread. But anyway, it's a complete list of who spends the money. And what I was impressed with, or surprised with, how few really big contributors or really wealthy people were here. We've got maybe three or four of the really, you know, big names in Minnesota business, you know, giving money. We've got somebody from 3M, which of course is Scotch Tape, and we've got, who have we got here? Kurt Carlson, big hotel, here we've got some Minnesota people over here. You'd know what I mean with Rudy, right? And is one of a kind. You have to say that for Rudy. He's certainly not. He's not a cook. He's not stamped out of the usual cookie mold. He sure isn't. Right. Okay. A few other peoples. You know, the Pillsbury's, the Weyerhausers. They're not here. If you're wondering how and where the money came from, you know, it would have to be at this point. And one thing has to be said. We had. I guess it got a lot of national attention. We had. A Democrat challenger for the incumbent, Senator Durenberger, and he comes from probably one of the wealthiest families in Minnesota, Dayton. His name happened to be Mark Dayton, and he happened to be married to a Rockefeller, which, you know, does have its advantages. And he spent something like $8 million, wasn't it, I think, finally, of his own money? But at the point with Dayton was that he didn't take one nickel from a political action committee. He didn't have to, obviously, but he didn't. And so, therefore, in one sense, he wasn't beholden really to anything else. All right, to anybody else. So, what I'm trying to say, first of all, is that there's always going to be money spent, and at least the money now is out in the open, so we know where it's going. And I think, secondly, small donors who once felt they had no influence now can pool their money with like-minded voters. And that means that people who want to give something, even though it might not be much, think at least they have some influence where they might not have had the case, you know, where there wouldn't have been the case before. And another point that's, I think, significant here is that political action committees furnish money to a degree that the political parties can't furnish. In other words, here what I'm getting at is that political campaigns are costing more and more money all the time. And in order to pay for the raising and escalating costs, people usually have at least gone to political parties. But parties simply don't have that kind of money anymore. People are disenchanted, or rather turned off by either one or both parties. And, you know, donations and collections for parties are going down. Parties are forever having to, you know, cut back on their staffs. And therefore, we've got, you know, a very difficult kind of, you know, situation. All right. Now, these are sort of the facts of life. Now, what Drew suggests are four or five things, and now I would like to get your reactions to these. She would suggest, by way of reform, first of all, to remember that we always run the risk of violating what she calls the law of unintended consequences. The law of unintended consequences. In other words, she said to hold back donors, for whatever reason, who want to give and who have the right to give, to hold back donors will simply mean that they will give their money in some less savory way, in some probably much more illegal kind of way than has been the case before. They might lead the people who want to give money, as you know, as I say, the rivers want to reach the sea, they might give them less worthy approaches. And I think that's one, you know, interesting idea. Secondly, she suggests, and I think this would be a very interesting one to discuss, she suggests that we have complete public financing of all, you know, office seekers. Have it all out in the open, having the only money for campaigning to be furnished by, you know, by public funds, the way it is for the presidency right now. The problem here, she sees, is a very logistical problem. Some districts cost much more money for redistricting than others. Let's say we have a checkoff. Let's use this one from the 1040. We have a 10 checkoff, and every campaign out of the 435 gets, let's say, the same amount of money. The only problem with that is that in some areas, it doesn't take any amount of money to be reelected. I don't know if you remember old Sam Rayburn from Texas. He probably didn't spend, you know, $10 other than his refiling fee. I don't even suppose he put out an old campaign poster, you know, because he just didn't need money. He was always going to be reelected to office. While other people, obviously now there's a new congressman from Houston this year who took $770,000 from PACs to get elected. He was the one who got all kinds of publicity because he switched from the Democratic to the Republican Party. But in Texas, there isn't any difference between Republicans and Democrats anyway, so it was pretty much a titular kind of change. But, you know, the idea of public financing is great in theory, but it runs up against the idea that some people need more money than others, and some people don't need money, as I say, like Sam Rayburn, don't need money at all. All right. Another feature I think which would be helpful is to raise the $1,000 limit that individuals can give, so long as you keep, you know, the disclosure feature, you know, right up in front. Now, one that strikes me as very interesting here is what's done in Western Europe. Western Europe allows no TV or radio political advertising, you know, absolutely none. You know, the German term gar nichts, there's just none at all for this. And they also say that, you know, like in England, which is something we always talk about here and won't do anything else about, that a campaign cannot last for more than 4 weeks. Now, Margaret Thatcher has called for a re-election, and we can see this in operation. There will be nothing spent ahead of time. Everything is done in 4 weeks. You don't, you know, you of course, England is much smaller than the United States. What is it? England is the size of Oregon, if I'm not mistaken. Did I pronounce that right? Oregon? I learned yesterday that there's some people are very fussy about Oregon, but anyway, campaigns are limited to 4 weeks, and obviously they don't spend very much money on those. Or the other alternative would be to limit the length of time of political commercials. Let me give you one example. More damage, you know, people are accustomed in this country to 30-second campaign, you know, commercials. Okay, because that's about our attention span, which really doesn't say much, you know, for Americans, our attention span. But The problem is, I mean, how many of you really, you know, like two, three nights before a campaign, when they have 5 minutes before for a whole campaign, how many of you really sit there and listen to all 5 minutes? Unless you're a true believer and you want to cheer on your candidate, you know, and I had a true believer. I was clean for Gene in 68. That's, you know, Gene McCarthy. And then I needed it like I needed, you know, evangelism, like I needed, you know, hymns or something sometimes to keep my spirits going. So I sat and watched these things even though I was already converted to this. But very few people, you know, watch all 5 minutes. But the problem, you see, is with a 30-second spot, it can do so much damage in 30 seconds that it'll take more than 5 or 10 minutes to refute it. So it's very difficult to be able to believe that free time, you know, for each candidate would help. Because the only way that would work would be to have some sort of censor ahead of time saying you can only talk about positive, constructive things you're going to do. And once we have that, then we start having limitations on the First Amendment, on freedom of speech. So you see the complications, you know, that are involved with this. So what I'm trying to suggest is that there are some very, you know, serious problems, which I want to repeat here in a minute very briefly, but, you know, there are some interesting alternatives that go along with this. Now, Drew concludes, and then I'll conclude with this. We are paying in the declining quality of politicians and of the legislative product and in rising public cynicism. We have allowed it to become increasingly difficult for the good people who remain in politics to function well. I think that's an interesting idea. It's very difficult to keep attracting good people. We've allowed it to become increasingly difficult for the good people who remain in politics to function well. Well, my colleague and I have a standing argument that if you're going to have good people in office, you're going to have to pay them more money. And he disagrees, and, you know, I agree. And there has to be, there should be, well, that's getting off this subject. I'll come to that later. Back to Drew. What results is a corrosion of the system and a new kind of squalor. The public knows that something is very wrong. As the public cynicism gets deeper, the political system gets worse. Until the problem of money is dealt with, the system will not get better. We have allowed the basic idea of our democratic process, representative government, to slip away. The only question is whether we are serious about trying to retrieve it. That's a powerful indictment. So I'd be glad to, we've got lots of time. Your comments, you know, whatever. I warned you ahead of time, I talk fast, so. Yeah, Jane?
I found that our political campaigns last so long, and it becomes so repetitious and irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because in 30 seconds you can't address an issue.
Right.
Or even in 5 minutes,
right,
you can't. But I found myself in quite a few recent years voting against one candidate rather than for another.
No question, and McGovern lost because he seemed inept in 19. People voted against McGovern instead of for Nixon, I think, in 72. Especially that $1,000 thing. Remember, he was going to give everybody a $1,000 rebate or something. You're right on that. And that's where the power of the media has become, you know, so paramount, because it's much easier to be negative than to be positive. Yeah, I wish I knew some, you know, some easy way around that. The only thing you can sort of go for there is something like happened in Maryland or Montana, like the marketplace, that the market, the American people might become so knowledgeable, so sophisticated about these things that they'll begin to understand the, you know, the negative, you know, they'll get tired of the negative kinds of things, maybe, but not necessarily.
The campaigns are so long that you almost feel like you've overdosed.
Yeah, I, you know, the last month or so, I'm totally numb.
Yes.
Nothing happens anymore. And what was it? Mondale announced in February this year, wasn't it? And Glenn announced, you know, in April, and it takes, you know, the political machinery is so complicated that it takes that much time to get all the workers and the, you know, the organization out, because you've got to organize people, you know, down to the precinct level, and you just can't sort of announce and then suddenly everybody's going to be there. They, you know, politics just doesn't work that way.
When you consider the short terms of our congressmen,
yeah. Yeah,
they hardly do anything but run for office.
That's right. In the House, that's all they do is run. They start, you know, Tim Penny has been back already in our district because he has to be. He's the first Democrat, you know, ever, and he wants to stay there. And I don't blame him for that. But they have to. And then, of course, that raises an interesting question. When Congress first passed the thing for 2 years for the House, they wanted to keep, you know, the House close to the people. 6 years for the Senate to give them a little more independence, a little more breathing room. The two things, the two-year term for the House to keep them close so that they wouldn't get too far away from the people. But what's happened now is that they never get away from the people at all. Yeah. and, or they think they don't. And the opposition is always there, as I say, with more money. And maybe it's possible, maybe it would be better if we had 4 years for the House and, say, 8 years for the Senate. Give them more time in office. But then, of course, they have more time for mischief.
That's right. That's
Well, just put a limit on how many terms they can serve.
And that's another one. Then we're saying, though, that experience doesn't count after a while.
Right.
I think so. I feel, having worked in the political system, that a lot of people go in with really good intentions.
Yeah.
But you get a lot of pressure put on you, and you get a lot of people who start treating you like God. And after a while, you lose touch with reality. I think, in my personal opinion, 8 years is long enough for the person, the first 2 years or 4 years, to start to really get to know the system and start to be effective. But after 8 years, they start losing touch with reality. And I feel that they should be forced to get back out and earn a living in the real world outside of politics. And that's, I'm very opinionated on
that. I would want to look at that point a little bit differently, but that's all right. Do you agree? Any comments on that about having a mandatory, limit on them? I like to tell stories about my hometown, Kenyon, and we had one man, Andrew Finstone, who was so powerful, he knew he'd be reelected, and he got, he knew where the power was, and the power was on the Ways and Means Committee. That's the money committee, if, that's a polite word for money. And he ran it. I mean, he ran the House in the state of Minnesota for, 25, 30 years, because he was so powerful and very clever at this. But then on the other hand, he did offer stability, and he offered continuity. From one.
I feel that the less government we have, the better off.
Well, you're one of the Thomas Jefferson.
See, I definitely feel that by putting a limit on it, you prevent stuff like that, and the government can do less.
Yeah, but you also have the other side of the coin in that if they don't have to stand for re-election again, they don't need to be so careful to represent their constituency.
Yeah, that's the main objection to this very interesting idea that I think Eisenhower first proposed, that the president should have one six-year term, period. And Carter supported it, Jerry Ford supported it, and that's the one objection to it is, I think that's the one thing that's good about it, is that you can't accuse the president of doing anything, simply to be reelected again.
But on the other hand,
he doesn't have to be accountable.
Then he isn't accountable,
right? That's kind of what Jane Byrne did in Chicago. Yeah. She hired all those people at the last minute.
Yeah, right. Yeah, her luck finally ran out. But the ghost of Jane Byrne might rise again, with that mess they have in the city council right now.
Yeah, I've read some commentators say that they're not sure that there will be a president with more than one four-year term again in the foreseeable. Right.
Because the job is too big for any one person, mm-hmm. and all the things that go wrong are dumped on the president.
Well, the re-election got to be automatic, so Ford and
Carter. Yeah.
People are taking a second look at that automatic re-election.
Yeah, because JFK would have been re-elected, no question about that. He would have been, as they said, he would have been re-elected on the lottery ticket, against Goldwater. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, that fourth, I suppose that's true. And I suppose the risks, like with the economy right now, are so great that we tend to blame the president for everything that goes wrong. And I'm tempted to make my own little personal statement about the incumbent here, but I won't. But I think one real problem we have there is the incumbent, the outsider who obviously is trying to get into office has to create a very negative attitude towards the incumbent.
Yes.
He has to make a case as to why, that the rascal should be, dropped from office. And that tends to breed a certain amount of cynicism in the public.
Also, sense of insecurity. Have we really been that badly governed?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, the thing I'm worried about, and I'm probably paranoid, but I just wonder about people getting together and putting money together and then electing an idiot who will do just what he's told so that we don't really have anything that anybody really elected. But we've got somebody that's just a mouthpiece.
Yeah.
But nobody can give that much money to one candidate anymore.
Well, I don't know. Some people say it's happened in the past in the history of our government. If you look back at some of the quote, do-nothing presidents that we had in between Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln.
See, you could get enough people in the big multi-international corporations to cooperate together on some common interest, and elect somebody who's just a good actor and knows how to act in front of the TV that say
I'm
not going to say that here, but really and truly, it's and then I think people are unreal in what they expect. People still think that, you know, I honestly think that one of the things that helped elect Reagan was that to a large number of people he got on the white horse and went off to the sunset on Death Valley days and took care of everything. And he can do it
naturally,
and that's so ignorant.
Yeah, and that creates all the backlash now, because obviously he hasn't, and nobody would be able to carry out even half of the things that he had, you know, that he had promised. So then that feeds the cynicism even more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would agree on that one. On the actors thing, I don't know. I'm just not sure. I see other people. For instance, one of my particular favorites is Andrew Young from Georgia and Mayer. And I think if he had a chance to get out in front of people, I mean, I think he would convert just about anybody, because the man, the integrity and the intelligence and the dedication of Young really comes through extremely. And so sometimes you need that.
How much of that can you hang on to?
Yeah.
See, you know more about the political process than I do, and I really would like to know, you know, are you pretty, how do you feel just personally about what I'm calling paranoia, that it has become so cut and dry that we aren't really electing, the common person is not really...
Well, no, I'm not so sure, because there really is a significant difference between Carter and Reagan. And something was at work. You know, we just weren't electing one more, you know, person who's sort of in the middle of the road. And that's what I'm trying to think, is that once in a while the American public does have a chance to influence, to make some influence felt. Let me give you just two examples. One would be the famous Saturday night firestorm when Nixon fired Archibald Cox, wasn't it?
No, right.
Yeah, and Ruckel's house and the whole thing went down the line, because the telegrams and everything else were felt in Washington, and some changes were made there. It doesn't happen very often. The other one, and one of the most amazing ones, and something that I think we should remember, is what happened, you know, with the yellow ribbons for the Iranian hostages. Suddenly, the American people did unite about an issue, and their voice was felt.
I think they can make an influence. Yeah. I'm talking about getting people elected, particularly a president. I think they still can influence senators and representatives. I'm talking about the president.
Well, Jimmy Carter came from nowhere, you know. I mean, you know, remember that once during the campaign they showed him on What's My Line, and nobody, you know, Dorothy Kilgallen and all of this, nobody knew who he was.
But, I guess I'm talking since Carter. I wonder if he was the last of the Mohegans.
Well, it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see who the Democrats come up with, because obviously Mondale, I should remember the name, I've known him since college, and is the front runner, but already he's beginning to slip. Now the polls are showing that Glenn is coming. But
he's an astronaut. Boy.
Yeah.
See, that he doesn't have a horse, he's got a missile. That's better.
He's got no pizzazz either, you know.
Well, just don't show him. Show the rocket.
But,
Early, I'm sure you've heard this.
Go, please.
This Swiss gnome conspiracy been going around for years, and there have been books written about it.
I have what I call Jorst. I've got three laws of history, and you'll get the first one here, is Jorst's first law of history. In the absence of evidence, conspiracy interpretations arise. Like is it Swiss bankers that are running the world? Is that
it's
the one?
The Swiss gnomes.
The Swiss gnomes are running the world.
Right.
G-N-O-M-E-S.
That makes it even more conspiratorial.
Okay. Right. Like, or it's some of you know the Bilderberger thesis. There's a resort hotel. I love to tell my conspiracy stories. If you don't want to listen to conspiracy stories, I'm going to tell them for the next few minutes here. But there's a resort, very swank resort hotel in Holland known as the Bilderberger. And it is true that in August, some of the top bankers in the world, the David Rockefellers, the Japanese, Minolta, or whatever their name is, come for 2 or 3 weeks of talking things over. And like any other group, they sit down and, you know, say, what are we going to do next? This has become a giant conspiracy. The Bilderberger thesis, if we could only get rid of the Bilderberger, you know, conspiracy, we do, well, my favorite story in my...
That's the trilateral, isn't it?
Yeah, the trilateral thing, right. My favorite is, when I was in college, I can't say that I worked for the State Highway Department in the summer, but I put in my time. You know, I stood out there with my little orange vest and everything else. And we would meet at the Home Plate Cafe at 6:30 every morning to get our ride out to where we were going to go. And old Melly Tooney sat there, and Melly, the world had sort of passed Melly by. He, the only thing that he ever did that he thought was important in the world was to fight in World War I, and he never got tired of telling us this the rest of his life. Every time we went over to see Melly, we'd see all his old pictures, and we'd stare at those things where the two pictures, you know, and, you know, all that. Well, Melly never amounted to much in life, and Melly always thought he should have amounted to something in life. So we had to find some explanation for this, and that obviously it couldn't be with his own lack of talent. So we would sit there in the, at the Home Plate Cafe, and Melly would pick out the Minneapolis Morning Tribune and read it over, and he would say, "Yeah, what have these damn British bankers done today?" the British bankers who had done this, or Senator, what was his name? Senator Hughes from Montana in the 1930s. It was war munitions manufacturers that have gotten us into World War I. And therefore, let's cut back on war munitions manufacturers. You know, one easy kind of interpretation. And I think that's always, and you know, that happened. You remember in the 1964 campaign, "None Dare Call It Treason," written by somebody named Phyllis Schlafly. If you're wondering what Phyllis Schlafly was doing before she found out about the ERA, she was writing anti-Johnson things. And "None Dare Call It Treason." A choice, not an echo. You remember that one? Maybe I'm reminding you of some things you just as soon forget here. But conspiracy interpretations are always very popular. Nixon got into office, you know, when he was because he found that Helen Hagen Douglas was pro-communist, and you know, the wife of Melvin Douglas, the actor.
He even put out the notice on pink paper.
Yeah, pink paper, right? Yeah, the Pink Lady, right? And that doesn't refer to a drink you get at a bar.
What he found was that she had voted the same way as some communists, by association.
And, you know, the real problem here is, I'm not so mad at Nixon or these other people. They simply exploit something that's in the American electorate. Yeah. You know, and is, so where do we put the blame? Last night we were talking about education. Is it that our high schools are failing us when people are so gullible? You know, I'm not saying this is just true for conservatives, this is true for liberals too. It works both ways.
I think a lot of it is there is too much information available. Even people in very select disciplines cannot begin to read all the material and go to all the conferences that affect their own little narrow discipline.
And we've given too much, you know, how do I say this, responsibility to the president to do these things. And when things like Rita Lavelle show up, obviously he's very embarrassed by it, and he should be, but there's no way in which any president, well, let's be bipartisan about this, the banker, for goodness sake, from Atlanta.
Oh, Burt Lance.
Burt Lance, there's something I'll spoil your lunch for you, is just bringing up Burt Lance, you know. If you read the story on Burt Lance, you know, he was allowed, you know, he's a banker, and fellow bankers, this is one of these plot things that I think is true here, he was allowed a $500,000 overdraft, you know, from another bank. I mean, if I'm $1 over First National Bank of Northfield, you know, your account has been overdrawn to the amount of. And these, you know, Burt Lance can get very big with you. Wouldn't it be nice to have a $500,000, you know, cushion? And here, you know, I've got
and
ready.
He still went over it.
Sure.
$600,000.
I've got ready reserve now, and I can go over up to $500 without. After a while, you know, but that's, you know, you're right on the information thing, and we so presidents get caught. That's where I was going with my.
That's why we can only elect the man, and that's why the man who's best able to communicate is going to be elected. You know, whether it's Reagan or the chairman.
Yeah, I really wonder whether, you
know.
Both of those cases you mentioned, though, I think there was a pattern. There's been a pattern of presidential appointments. Carter appointed his old friends from long since who weren't qualified.
Yeah,
Reagan has appointed the people who have established their record by fighting the very regulations that he's putting them in office to represent. And in both cases, you're asking for trouble.
Yeah, they did, because they were both were totally incompetent on the national level. Yeah, the old Georgia boy, you know, circuit. That's true. And his attorney general too, Bell, turned out to be something less than, you know, somebody who'll have his picture on Mount Rushmore or something.
Nothing embarrasses us so much as our friends and often our children.
Yeah. Well, you know, then of course what happens is, you know, I could just, one last thing to sort of to bring this to a more probably theoretical level. Responsible level. Maybe Reinhold Niebuhr was right in his idea of moral man and immoral society. That we can have, and I'd like to talk about this on Thursday, unless Dan gave a preview for Thursday or Wednesday. I can give a preview here for mine on Thursday. You're doing one tomorrow, aren't you, at this plot?
Yes.
Yeah, right, okay.
Technology.
I'll do my commercial now, and then you can do yours for tomorrow. But maybe Niebuhr was right in arguing that we can elect good men to office. We can be very careful and pick out good people in office, but they can't be good individually in office on a social level the way they are on a personal level. Maybe, you know, the implications for their goodness simply won't be available for them. But anyway, let's talk about that. Should we elect, you know, quote, good, let me rephrase that, I didn't do that quite right. Should we elect, quote, good people to office? Will that be, you know, will that be the answer?